measured. Doesn't anyone want to hazard any guess? What the hell? I mean, just make one up if so inclined. You know, I mean, again, I don't bite, and, you know, it's just a game we play.
I'll try it with Galileo when he was looking at the moons, you know, when they came around the backside of Jupiter. The timing was wrong, so that would be the 1600s. I don't know, Roy. I'm going to go with the late 1600s.
Okay, yeah, he got the time terribly wrong because there was another astronomer, I think his name was Romer, who later on used a similar method and came up with a somewhat more decent, I think he was off only by 10%, which was pretty good. But if you talk to enough physicists, they'll tell you that he inferred an assumption that the speed of light was the same going in both directions, and so that wouldn't qualify either. I'll give everyone one last little try because I guess no one's heart is in this one. If you want to hazard any kind of a guess for what age of science this was calculated, please hit that push to talk button.
I say Apollo program.
Okay, I'm not really aware of the Apollo program including a experiment on the speed of light. Paul, if you could shine some light on this.
Well, he's talking about the reflector, the corner reflector that's on the moon, where they were trying to actually judge the exact distance of the moon. That's what it sounds like he's talking about. I don't know. Maybe it's something different that I don't know about. They left reflectors on the moon, or I think all of the missions did. I know Apollo 11 did.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, I think the principle was not to recalculate the speed of light in a vacuum, but simply to act as a distance measuring device, so that they could actually see how the distances change over time. Well, I'll cut it short. They haven't done it yet. Pretty much every single measurement of the speed of light has required them to really use a two-way trip. What usually happens is they have some kind of timing device at one point. It triggers when the light is released. It goes a distance, hits a mirror, gets reflected back, and when it's detected back at the beginning, it stops the timer, and with a known measurement of the distance, it calculates the speed of light in the vacuum. And pretty much all the experiments so far have required people to insert a assumption that light can travel in both directions at the same time. It is theoretically possible that light can travel at one half the speed of light in one direction and infinitely fast in the other direction, and we would get the same results, although it is incredibly highly unlikely that there is a directionality of space-time. But that's the answer to the question. We're still waiting for some clever person to do an experiment to do this. The problem is that if you don't use a common place, then you don't quite know whether your time standard is correct or not, because it's someplace else and subject to some changes. So that's a problem. So far, it's only the speed of light going back and forth, not the speed of light going in one direction.
Roy, this is WSLN. Couldn't they use the quantum computer system? You know, where the something happens at the exact same time. Let's say if you're on, you know, 25,000 miles out and you have a satellite out there, and, you know, somebody on Earth, you know, they could have a quantum effect. You know, China's got it with satellites already. So now you could time a radio transmission from when it gets transmitted from the satellite down to Earth, and by looking out, you know, that, like we just said before, spookiness at a distance. If something changes on Earth, and it doesn't match or it gets close to the speed of light, you would have an accurate number.
Yeah, Paul, that's an interesting idea. It's not exactly quantum computers that you would need. It's just quantum entanglement that you would need. And it gives you that spooky problem that I mentioned earlier, that all of a sudden, you know, I was busy talking about the speed limit of causality in space-time, and entangled the particles seem to kind of rip a hole right through it. So first, everyone's got to figure out exactly what's going on with quantum entanglement and whether this is truly instantaneous or we're missing something important. But, yeah, that might be an interesting method of using as a timer, as a using a pair of quantum entangled particles and triggering them, from a release of the photon to a reception of the photon at the other point. So that's an interesting thing to think about. Thanks. I'll Google a bunch of it. I haven't read any place where they tried anything like that, so there may be some kind of a technical problem with that, but interesting.
Okay, very good. I heard they're shipping the first quantum computers somewhere. I think NASA's involved. I've read some article recently. There's actually two computers that are actually going to be put into operation in commercial service very shortly. So maybe we could do it real soon, Roy.
Well, again, you don't actually need a quantum computer. It's kind of overdoing things. You just need a quantum entangled particle. And you can, and you might be able to handle it. I actually have that as one of my many articles as a science talk. So I'll just pull it out and then I'll read it to you guys and gals. It's about IBM. They're actually selling quantum computers to someone other than their own branch. So let me drop for a sec and I will start this little story. Okay, quantum computing has been positioned as a revolutionary tool for healthcare that can help with everything from clinical trials to disease registries to electronic health records. Now more than ever, with the world in the throes of a pandemic, it's easy to see the advantages of the new tech for medical professionals. To reap some of those benefits, the Cleveland Clinic is partnering with IBM on a discovery accelerator that will see it utilize quantum computing tools combined with artificial intelligence and cloud technologies. As part of the 10-year collaboration, the nonprofit medical center will become the world's first private sector company with an on-premises IBM quantum computer. The system is the first machine of its kind to be built by the company to be sold outside of its own facilities. In the future, the Cleveland Clinic will also purchase a 1,000-plus qubit IBM next-generation quantum system for installation at a data center in its hometown. Researchers plan to use the cutting-edge tools to crunch mountains of data that could help with breakthroughs in genomics, single-cell transcriptomics, population health, clinical applications, and chemical and drug discoveries. Let me drop for a sec. Unlike traditional computers that use individual bits to store information in binary states, quantum machines harness the principle of quantum theory to deliver massive leaps in processing power. Their basic unit of memory is a quantum bit or a qubit that can take different arrangements as part of a system known as a superposition. Qubits can also be linked together using a phenomenon called quantum entanglement. This effectively allows the computers to perform 1 billion or more copies of a computation at the same exact time. In a nutshell, the computers can be used to solve far larger mathematical problems than their current counterparts, including in areas like encryption and artificial intelligence. The Discovery Accelerator will serve as the technology foundation for the Cleveland Clinic's new Global Center for Pathogen Research in Human Health. Over the next decade, researchers will use IBM's cloud, robotics, and quantum computing tech to remotely design and synthesize molecules, analyze molecular features and viral and bacterial genomes to boost drug discovery and breakdown, and potentially obtain deeper insights from structured and unstructured data at a faster rate than ever. Quote, through this innovative collaboration, we have a unique opportunity to bring the future to life, said Tom Mihalchik, MD, CEO and president of Cleveland Clinic. These new computing technologies can help revolutionize discovery in the life sciences. The Discovery Accelerator will enable our renowned team to build a forward-looking digital infrastructure and help transform medicine while training the workforce of the future and potentially growing our economy. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, no comments, but that's the story on the quantum computers that IBM is selling Cleveland Clinic. Let me throw out one last puzzle before I bid you all adieu. It's not quite, but close to an agricultural question. Everyone has a bottled water in their refrigerator someplace. Why the heck does bottled water have an expiration date?
And Y2H.
Yes, Lou.
Would it be because of leaching of the plastic from the container into the water?
Yep, you got it. It's basically the expiration date of the bottle as opposed to the water itself. But, yeah, that's the life expectancy they give for the bottle itself to not start to dissolve into the water. So that's the answer. So you win this one. Okay, well, we've gotten to 10:14. I just want to remind everyone that if you have puzzles yourself and you'd like to share them with me, I could always use more. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, have a lot of links available, and if you want to take a look at that Elon Musk parody, it's a video. I have it up there on a link, probably for temporary because it takes up a lot of space. And there are other articles available and YouTubes that I found interesting that I think many of you would find as well. There was one interesting one describing Bitcoin. So that's at my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. And always want to remind people, MikeKC2NJI has his wonderful website that archives a lot of technical nets going back to September 2006. That's amateurradio.tv. So keep those all in mind. And now I will call upon Paul, WS2N, to give us this edition of the SpaceNet Report.
Okay, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N. And if you have a minute, it's not too hard. I'm asking you to change one of the years on that photo I sent with the Psyche spacecraft. I put 2025. It should have been 2022, Roy. I don't know if it's too hard to change. No, that's okay.
Done.
Okay, thank you very much. And while I'm talking about mistakes, I want to is on NYGY. I gave him information last week that was off. I'm thinking about something else, and I should have been thinking about the proper company. I was telling him about the building of Orion, the Orion spacecraft. I'm thinking the SLS, the main part of the spacecraft. I think $14 billion they've already poured into it, and the SLS is being built by Boeing, but the actual spacecraft itself is Lockheed Martin. One of you out there, Hank, N1YDYWS21.
I am, Paul. Thank you very much. And I guess that completely negates my my question about the Boeing Starliner and the Orion spacecraft. But anyway, thank you very much, N1YDY. Back to you.
Yeah, I kind of conflate the two. Of course, the Starliner is definitely Boeing. And the problem there is, too, even with Starliner, it's being launched on Atlas. So the Atlas V, which is the main part, the big part of the rocket, that rocket is being built by United Launch Alliance, ULA, which is a consortium between Boeing and Lockheed. Their job to build the rocket itself, but yet they split off, and Boeing's doing the Starliner. And hopefully that gets off the ground this year. I think probably August or so, the Starliner should be launched to the space station, again, without a crew. 2 Decembers ago, it didn't make it, so we talked about that. Okay, now let me drop it.
K2SDP.
Good evening, Chris. K2SDP, WS2N.
Thanks, Paul. Just really quickly, I wanted to say thanks. At the beginning of the TechNet, when Roy was starting out, you mentioned the ISS was going overhead. So I quickly ran to the back of my house and watched it go over. It was absolutely awesome. That was perfect time. It looked crystal clear today. And secondly, Roy, if you're listening, your Bitcoin link, you're missing the H at the very beginning, so the link doesn't work. The HTTPS, you just have TTPS. You might want to fix that link. Back to you, Paul.
Okay, and very good on the ISS going over. Yeah, that was good. That was a negative 4.5 magnitude. So, the lower the number, the brighter it is. Any time it's like minus 2 or above, I definitely go out there and try to look at it. I've seen minus 1 point. That's a little hard to see, but you get up to minus 4.5 and it's really good. And I give you an idea of magnitude. If you keep going all the way to minus 27, that would be the sun. But let me pass it over to Roy, make sure Roy got your message.
Yeah, I got it and I fixed it, so it should work now. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, very good. And, and then tomorrow night there's a pass, but it's not as bright. Same with the following night. And then there isn't anything for a while after that. But anytime I see that's coming up, we'll make an announcement for it. It's always pretty impressive. And with all the stuff they have attached to it now, it's as big as a football field, but now they have one Progress spacecraft attached to it, one Soyuz manned spacecraft attached to it. You have a Dragon spacecraft attached to it. And then there's another cargo vehicle, the Japanese HCV, and that's still attached. So it creates a lot of light when the sun reflects off it. Let me start off with the Psyche spacecraft that's being built. The spacecraft is going to be sent to an asteroid in the asteroid belt called Psyche. and launch, like I was just telling Rory, in 2022. They're going to use the Falcon Heavy to do it, but it's going to be with solar panels and all the solar panels are going to make it as big as a tennis court. So it's going to be a larger spacecraft. It's going to have a big 7-foot diameter antenna to communicate with Earth. It's going to have a SEP propulsion system. SEP is a solar electric propulsion. So, you know, essentially ion. And that's one of the reasons they're going to need the big solar panels. They have a pretty good size ion engine that's going to be operated to not only push it, accelerate it to the asteroid belt, but when it gets there, they would like to be able to put this into orbit around the around that asteroid Psyche. And it's a small but dense asteroid. It's like 150 miles in diameter. You know, figure the length of Long Island. You know, so it's relatively small, but dense. So it will go into orbit around that. They'll take pictures. They want to investigate this particular asteroid because they think it was the core of a planet that might have got blown apart, and this is what's left of it. So they're going to have different experiments on board, different instruments, a magnetometer to check out its magnetic field, a multispectral imager. They'll use that for imaging. And, of course, they'll have a spectrometer. They'll want to analyze any neutrons or gamma rays coming off the surface to determine what the elements are. And one other experiment I find interesting is they're going to use communication high data rate laser system from that asteroid belt. And, they'll transmit pictures and data using that, and that's always an ultimate goal because, future manned missions to Mars and beyond, they definitely want to use a laser type communication with that kind of bandwidth. You could send a lot of, you could send video back and forth, no problem. So that's the story on that. It's going to launch, and then they'll use Mars as a gravity assist to try to accelerate it, and it should get there 2026. So, got a long way to get information back, but once it's there, minimum time in orbit will be almost 2 years, 21 months. So, looking forward to that, and we'll be covering that hopefully in the years to come. Another topic I wanted to talk about is Ingenuity, but let me drop it and see if anybody has any questions. Okay, Ingenuity is the name of the helicopter that flew on Perseverance all the way to Mars. Perseverance, of course, landed it successfully in February 18th, and it's been getting ready and testing everything out on board Perseverance as well as the helicopter Ingenuity ever since it landed. So they knew it was going to take around a month or so before they could test Ingenuity, at least a month or two, and they're getting to that point. They've released this oil pan, from a car. It was a dustpan cover to protect the helicopter from landing. The helicopter's on the belly of the rover, so when the rocket engines slow it down before it lands, they didn't want to destroy the helicopter. So now, it landed, everything's safe, the pan came off, and then they moved out of the way, left the pan behind. After Ingenuity rolled, 10, 20 feet away, then they checked out the helicopter, and line that was mounted on a 90-degree angle, and then they release another clamp, and then have an electric motor that drives the helicopter down to a, back to a vertical facing position. And in doing that, the legs pop open. You have four legs that are now properly positioned. And then yesterday they sent pictures back of what it looks like now. They had a pyrotechnic go off, which cut the cable and released the helicopter at the same time. Helicopter dropped to about 5 inches onto its 4 feet. Again, sitting below Perseverance. Perseverance rolled out of the way, and looks like about 50 feet or so. They took a picture back, looking back at the helicopter, sitting there all by itself, recharging its batteries. They had to move the vehicle within 24 hours once the cables were cut, the data cables, battery charging cables. Then Ingenuity is on its own. It was sitting underneath the spacecraft. It wouldn't get any sun, but they needed to move that rover within 24 hours, otherwise you'd have your batteries would completely fail. And you need the batteries at night to put on little heaters on the inside of this cube-like helicopter. Anyway, I'll have to worry about that now. Sitting in the sun, and again, you have roughly 12-hour days on Mars, and at night the heaters come on, being heated from the batteries, heavily insulated on the inside to keep the electronics warm and the cameras warm. Two cameras are on board. So looking forward to the 8th, predicting now the 8th of this month, the 4th, right? So 4 more days from now. Maybe 5 more days we'll get information on whether or not this was a success. First flight, it's only going to go up maybe 5 feet or so on the ground. It'll fly around for 30 seconds, come back down and land. It's just going to translate, move to a different location. So come down and land. And they'll be taking pictures of each other. The rover will take a picture of the helicopter. The helicopter will take a picture of the rover. And if that's successful, they'll do this around 4 different times. Each time, extending the flight more, up to, I think, a minute and a half. So, this is an engineering experiment. If this works, they'll be able to use this, of course, on future missions. And they really are looking into, all the information about how the rotors and motors perform. They'll take all that information, and that will be part of another flight that will eventually go to Titan. Titan is going around Saturn. There's a mission planned many years from now called the Dragonfly, and that's going to have 8 different rotors on that vehicle. The theory is plan is have this come down on a parachute and actually separate before it lands, have the blades turn on and actually fly and land, and then be able to fly and keep going to different locations. They plan on having a RTG on board that plane, too far from the sun to use solar panels. So every time it lands, the RTG, or radioisotope thermoelectric generator, RTG will recharge the batteries. And then during the day, depending on how many days it takes to recharge it, whenever the batteries completely recharge, Dragonfly will be able to fly somewhere else. So that will be the ancestor of Ingenuity. So hopefully we'll look to see that launch. Don't have a planned date for Dragonfly, but I've seen the design for it. Jeff McMuscle and I were involved with eventually doing that mission. But they got to get past this one first. And future Mars missions. I can see a time when we have manned missions to Mars. I could see them flying helicopters to different places to do, different surveillance purposes. I could envision them bringing helicopters on flights, future flights to Mars. Any questions or comments? WS2M. NY2H. How you doing, Luke? NY2H, WS2M. Yeah, good. Did I get something on the news? Did they take a piece of fabric from the Kitty Hawk and put it on that helicopter? Yes, they did. Right below the rotor, where the rotor's been. They said it's about the size of a, less than the size of a postage stamp. They, pushed it in there somehow. real carefully. I think what they did is they wrapped it around one of the wire cables that are involved with the helicopter. Back to you. All right. Complete the circle. NY2H. Yeah, they do things like that. Like New Horizon, when that went to Pluto and passed Pluto, still in operation. They put small amount of ashes from Tom Thompson. Gotta pronounce his name. Not the block. But the guy that discovered Pluto. I'll think of it in a second. Begins with a T. A lot of strange things they not come up with. And a lot of good ideas for things that have happened in the past. Let me drop it. Towns Bar, is it? I don't know. I forgot the guy's name. Anyway, he's got a nephew that's involved with amateur radio. The discoverer of Pluto has a nephew that was recently involved, in Arizona, one of the anniversaries or something. And he was involved with a special event. Let me move on to the next topic. Tonight we have the Europa Clipper story. Europa Clipper is a flight that's being prepared that will eventually go to the moon of Europa, which orbits Jupiter. And that launch is planned for 2024. So that will not orbit the moon of Europa, although that's one reason they're going there. Because of the high radiation that close in to where Europa is located to Jupiter. Jupiter has a real super high radiation coming off that planet. And if you go too close, spacecraft won't last too long. So Europa Clip is going to have this 1-inch thick ball, titanium, and that's where all the electronics and stuff are going to be. But they still can't spend too much time near Europa. So what they're going to do is orbit Jupiter, and every time they come near Europa, it'll be they're going to have at least 40 orbits. That's the planned mission. So 40 times you'll come close to that moon. Every time they come close to the moon, they'll take all the readings that they need to take, spectrometers, able to photograph it, different infrared, wavelengths, including some kind of particle detector where, let's say, Europa is shooting water out of the surface of Europa, which they know happens now and then, and the Europa Clipper passes through it, will be able to physically taste the whatever molecules are coming off of that thing, and they'll be able to try to analyze it, see if it's organic. They think Europa has so much water underneath the surface of the ice that it's equal to twice the amount of water that's on Earth. So, you know, they know it's liquid underneath because of the pull of Jupiter. You know, you have this gravitational tiding effect that actually develops enough heat on the inside of Europa to keep it, you know, relatively warm. So naturally, the scientists are looking, you know, is there anything alive, you know, bacteria-wise, or, you know, maybe a squid or something, you know, floating around in Europa. They'll investigate that. This thing won't land there. I mean, they have plans way into the future actually landing something there with nuclear power and able to drill through, you know, or melt itself through miles of ice to actually get a submarine underneath the surface of the ice to actually move around and swim around deep in the oceans of Europa. I mean, that's long term plans of actually doing that. Excuse me. This is WS2M. But for now, Europa Clipper is going to be investigating how deep that ice is. And one of the ways they're going to do it is with a radar system. They have two different types of antennas that are going up. One that's going to be an HF antenna, and then another one that's going to be a VHF antenna. And they have something called, what do they call this thing? Reason. Reason is an acronym for what they plan on doing. I think it's called Radar for Europa Assessment and Sounding Oceans to the near surface. So they're calling it Reason, which is essentially two different antennas. One's an HF, and the other one is four VHF antennas. Anyway, I sent to Roy a picture of them testing out this 50-foot antenna, 50-foot dipole antenna. Look at these two of them. They're made of copper. But the picture that I sent is, you know, these people testing it out. They have it outside. They have it brought up on a mast. It's a tower. And then they have a bunch of guy wires holding it because this copper pipe wouldn't be able to be held, you know, straight. So this setup is holding it, you know, because it's on Earth. It would be all bowing and it just wouldn't work right. But in space, it would go out completely straight. And there's two of these things. And, you know, it turns out they're going to be using 17-meter HF radar, transmit a signal down, hit the ice, go below the ice, and then have the signal come back. So, you know, every other split second, you're going to transmit and receive on these antennas. And they plan on being able to get a lot of information from that. And they also have VHF antennas that are going to be doing the same thing. But there was a website that showed these things opening up, and especially the dipole, the 50-foot antenna. They had it on a table, and then it was like in a case. You hit a button, and you can hear a motor spinning, so it's going to extend this, you know, it's naturally 50 feet long. You can't go up like that in a spacecraft. It's going to be short. It's only going to be like maybe a foot long. somehow this thing is going to expand itself, you know, almost like the like a stepper antenna, you know, maybe there's some kind of a rod inside this thing that's going to extend it. It doesn't look telescopic. It almost looks like a straight piece of pipe when it comes out. So I don't think it's curled up. I just don't know how they do it, but, you know, they hit a button and he's, you know, one goes one way and one goes the other way, you know, two elements of his dipole, and it shoots out. Let's open up in about 3 seconds, less than that, about 2 seconds. It's pretty incredible. They had it on one of the sites. I should have copied that URL down. I could probably find it again. But, you know, you hit play and watch this thing open. Really something. You know, if you look at this tower with this dipole on it, and then they have looks like a cherry picker type of setup in front of it. And that's got another antenna. So they must be testing it, you know, between the two different antennas, seeing what it's doing. I'm not really sure what they're doing, but, you know, this looks like millions of dollars, multi-millions of dollars worth of equipment just to test out a dipole. Incredible. And that's what NASA and JPL, I forget which group is doing this. Sometimes it's a college, like in Arizona or somewhere. Although, I think this whole thing is being built by Jet Propulsion Laboratory. You can see what it looks like anyway on Roy's website. Anyway, this is WS2N. Got two large tanks, and, you know, one over the other. Each one is like 6 feet long. And then fuel, but fuel for an ion type of engine. But they got plenty of fuel in this thing. They're going to need it because it's going to be doing a lot of loops around Jupiter. This should be quite interesting. I haven't figured out what spacecraft they're going to, or what rocket they're going to use. The original plan from NASA, they had a deal with Congress that it would go up on a space launch system, an SLS. But I don't know if that's going to be in the cards by the time this thing launches. They might use, they might have to make a deal with SpaceX to launch it. We'll see. But, there you go. Any questions about Europa Clipper? Actually, SpaceX isn't the only game in town. There's another one called Blue Origin that's coming along. They just don't have that many launches. They've done about, I think, 14 suborbital flights with the New Shepard out in Texas, where they launch it up and they separate the spacecraft and comes down in a parachute. That's eventually going to have a crew inside, and the booster comes down, lands vertically, successfully, one flight after the other. They've done some work for NASA. They have an engine that run on liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, called the BE-3. So, you know, again, very successful with that. I thought by now they'd be sending crews up. You know, that, I guess that's still on hold. But under development in Florida, not Texas, is the this massive building that they put up. They started building years ago. Now that building is finished. And that's where they're going to be building the New Glenn. The New Glenn is going to be almost the size of the Saturn V rocket, over 300 feet tall, probably about 25 feet in diameter. Going to have 7 engines on the first stage, and they're going to use engines that they're building called the BE-4 engine. BE-4 engines are being tested. They got certified by NASA, and actually NASA's going to use them on the new Vulcan rocket that's being built, with two of them on. Each one is like over 500,000 pounds of thrust, so they'll have over 1 million pounds of thrust on the Vulcan that comes online probably within a year. But those same engines will be put on the new Glenn. It's going to be Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin rocket. Again, that will be liquid methane, not liquid hydrogen, liquid methane, liquid oxygen, very similar to what Elon Musk is doing. He's got a liquid methane, liquid oxygen system as well. But this company is redone, Launch Complex 36. Launch Complex 36 was inactive for 10 years or more. And that's the one they used to fly the Atlas rockets on. And they launched Pioneer on those from those launch complexes years ago. Blue Origin got the contract to, you know, pretty much demolish it and build their own setup. And they said they're pretty much coming along. They're like almost done. So they're more or less waiting for the rocket to be completed, and that will not go probably until early spring of next year, like a year from now. They'll be able to. And that would be man-rated, so eventually they would be able to send astronauts up on that. But, and they, you know, before that, of course they'll be sending up just satellites. But they'll have the capability of sending something to the moon. Jeff Bezos has a preliminary contract to land on the moon. I plan on using his rockets to do that. That will be the descent stage for the next moon mission. So he'll need the capability to actually get something like that to the moon, and he probably used the new Glenn. But the lander itself is a different engine, BE-7. So they have three different engines. That new Glenn is dealing with the BE-3 on the suborbital New Shepard mission. And then they have the BE-4 that will be sold to NASA for the new Vulcan rocket. And those same BE-4s will be used, they'll use seven of them for the first stage. I believe they're going to use two more for the second stage of the new Glenn rocket. And eventually they'll have a third stage, which will use the BE-3 engine, the one that's being used presently. And they'll just use that as a third stage when they really want to put a heavy weight into say geosynchronous orbit or maybe an interplanetary mission. So that's the story on New Glenn. I don't talk about it much. I mean, it's slow in development. Not like Elon Musk. He's turning these things out, like cookie cutters out in Texas. But I think Jeff Bezos does things a little differently. More like NASA, check this, check that, test this little part, and then before we really test anything. Where Elon Musk, put it together close enough, watch it, see what works and what doesn't work, and then we'll just, mass produce these things. And that's the way he does things. Any questions? WS1. Okay. Talk about SpaceX. I know they have an important flight coming up at the end of April. They're going to be launching a crew to the International Space Station. We talked about that before. Last couple of weeks, they'll have a new crew of four. Out of the four, three of them are hams. All four have been up to space before. They're all experienced. But they'll be replacing the crew of four that's up there now. Right now you have a crew of seven. So when we got to see that space station go overhead tonight, seven people were on board. Eventually, I think the 9th or... anyway, this week they're going to be launching another Progress vehicle to the space station with three people on board. Temporarily, you're going to have a crew of 10 up there for now. And then I think it's about a week or so from now, the three that were on the first Russian vehicle, including two Russians and including astronaut Kate Rubin, she'll be coming down with the two Russians on the next flight. But, you know, they'll land in Kazakhstan, and then, you know, again, you'll have seven on board. And then before the four that are up there that came up on a Dragon, you're going to have another four come up on another Dragon and dock with the space. Now, to do that, they really want to have eventually the top or zenith part of the docking system free. They need that because after all of that, they're going to send another Dragon up, and that one needs to go into that position because they're going to use the robotic arm to reach into the trunk of that Dragon and take out a ROSA system, R-O-S-A, or roll out solar array, which will be installed on the International Space Station. There's going to be a number of them over the next couple of years. So they got to, you know, maneuver things around. Right now, the spacecraft with the crew on board is docked in the forward position on the Harmony node number two, they call it. And Harmony is, you know, they've got to move the spacecraft, and they've temporarily put this on the top, on a zenith port. So I think another day or so, they're going to put all four people in that spacecraft. They're going to back it away from the spacecraft, and then they're going to move it and put it on top of the other port. That will leave the forward port open for the new crew that's going to be coming up at the end of the month. And this crew eventually is going to leave. When they leave, they'll be able to leave that top port open. And then they'll fly back and land in the Atlantic Ocean and be picked up by a SpaceX ship and brought back to Houston. But that will leave that top port open. And then eventually the crew vehicle will dock with that. So they're going to be maneuvering quite a bit on the American side temporarily. On the Russian side, they'll be bringing a crew up, and a crew will be going down. So there's going to be a lot of activity within this month of April. Any questions or comments? WS1. And the mission plan, I believe it's in October, by SpaceX. There's another Dragon mission that does not go to the National Space Station. They're going to have a crew of four. And they're going to fly higher than the space station for a couple of days and then come back. They have four people. One guy is like a billionaire from a company called Ship 4 Payments. It's a fellow, Jared Isaacman. He got involved with Elon Musk, and he's willing to put up a lot of the money to do this, to fly a commercial flight. These four people that are going to be going up, never went up into space before, but he'll be the commander. This has nothing to do with NASA. My guess it won't even be on the NASA TV. You'll have to watch it on the SpaceX webcast to see what's going on for the launch when they're in space. And then there's three other people that are going to be going with him. Christopher Zimbowski comes out of Lockheed Martin. He's an engineer from the state of Washington. And then Sian Proctor, she's a professor from Tempe, Arizona. There's a couple of them around the country. One in Hawaii, one in Utah, where they duplicate being on Mars, their spaces, you know, they'll put like a crew four or five people in a habitat as if they're on Mars, and they won't see anybody for like months at a time. They'll eat in there, you know, like, just like they're on Mars. They have, you know, different titles. You have a commander and all that. You know, somebody cooks. And when they go outside, they put on these spacesuits because, you know, theoretically, going outside, you can't do that on Mars. These are, you know, these type of things that go on a regular basis for years now. And this one person, she was one of these people, this professor, college professor from Arizona. So she tried to go to be an astronaut. You have thousands of people trying to, they need a new group that's coming in. And I think she was around the 45. But, you know, they were only choosing, I think, 9 or 10 that year. So naturally she didn't make it. But she made this. So she's going to be on this flight along with Haley. I can pronounce the name. I don't know what the last name is. But anyway, Haley was a patient when she was a little kid in St. Jude Hospital. And she got cured of cancer at that hospital. So, I mean, there was going to be some kind of a deal where they were going to try to raise money for the hospital. They thought it was going to get like $200 million. I think they only got $13 million from this whole event that they're trying to do with this launch. Anyway, she was chosen, you know, early on to go up, and she'll be the youngest person, the youngest American actually to fly. She's in her 20s. This crew of four. And Elon Musk has developed a system with the spacecraft Dragon. He's creating like a cupola, like a little window, a round window where you could, you know, stand up and get your head, you know, in this window like that, and you could look all around. And, you know, then you could get out of it. The other person goes into it. So this is what's inside the spacecraft. To give you an idea of what I'm saying is, when you dock with the space station, you come up with the spacecraft, and when they get into space, they open up the front end of the spacecraft, and that exposes the docking mechanism, and that's what docks with the space station. It also exposes four thrusters that, you know, point in the forward direction. That are active. So now he's designed this window, this round window, so that when you open up the front of the spacecraft, this round window will be exposed. You won't need a docking clamp because you won't be going to the space station. So you don't need any docking mechanism. He'll still utilize this. You still have to have this piece open up anyway. You need your thrusters to be exposed. So he figures while he's doing that, he'll just, you know, build this one glass window, a round sphere-like thing that you could stand up with inside float you know, up to the top part of the spacecraft and look outside. So they're calling it a cupola, just, you know, similar to a small cupola. They have a big one on the International Space Station where you can put, like, two people in and look out. Big trapezoidal windows, six of them with a 1 meter diameter window above that, so you get a 360 degree view. But this is a real small version of it. You can put one head inside this thing at a time to look around. Any questions or comments? WS2N. Okay, come to a grinding halt. Went on long enough here, I think. You know, Elon Musk keeps trying with these Starship vehicles. Last week he tried again, destroyed another one, the Starship number 11. That means he destroyed destroyed four of these things now, where they launched, they come down, supposed to land vertically, and they blow up for one reason or another. So he's still trying, and now he's got another one that's going to come out to the launch pad probably within a week or two, an upgraded version. So we'll have to wait and see how this thing does. Maybe this one will make it, but about four in the wrong direction.